The Canadian Anti-Apartheid Oral Histories Project was produced in association with the 3rd Annual Institute of African Studies Conference and Feshrift in honor of Linda Freeman, Solidarity and Shifting Patterns of Hegemony in Southern Africa, Historical and Contemporary Perspectives, which was held on March 1st and 2nd, 2018, at Carleton University. This Oral Histories Project consists of interviews with participants of the conference, including activists, aid workers, diplomats, and politicians, who volunteered to discuss their personal experiences as part of the anti-apartheid movement in Canada. The interviews were conducted by Susan Bazilli, PhD student at the University of British Columbia, and by myself, Michael Buchert, a PhD student at Carleton University. In this interview, Zeb Jeeva sat down with Susan Bazilli to talk about his experiences as a South African exile in Toronto and his grassroots fundraising for the African National Congress. This was recorded on February 28th, 2018 at Carleton University.
So Zeb, tell me a little bit about where you were born and your early years growing up in South Africa.
So, Susan, I was born in a little town called Zierist, which was near the border of Botswana. And my parents had business in the so-called Native Reserve. And it was just so wonderful there because my parents' business was sort of the center of the community there. Of course, they got their, requirements. But also my parents, also from the small farmers who could not send their products or their, harvest, to some big mills for this thing. So my parents used to buy this from the small farmers. And then as a whole, send it out, And then, we also built a water, center. So people from around could come and get water from the place. My dad also was able to get a doctor to come once a week, to the place. So, it was servicing the community. Well, in 1956, we had to leave. The place was expropriated because Indians could not stay and trade in native reserves. And I think that is when I was 10 years old, and I realized, hey, this is not right. And I think this is where, I got started and my activism really, got going.
Where did your family move to?
So then we moved to Zierist, the little town, for a little while, but that didn't work out. So then eventually we had to move to Johannesburg. And so I did most of my schooling and so on in Polokwane, which was Pietersburg, Benoni, and so on. And then when I matriculated, I applied to WITS, to do BCom, and I was, accepted by WITS. But then I had to apply to the Minister of Interior for permission to study at a white university, which he declined. And then my parents were in no position to send me to Britain, where I wanted to go to the UK to study, but they were not in any position to do that. So they sent me to Pakistan for a while. I was there for 2 years, but then the family was going through a rough time, so I came back. And even just that 2 years that I spent in Pakistan, I realized what a free life was and all that. When I got back, I said, I was, of course, involved with, young people on, discussing anti-apartheid or the apartheid system and so on. And at that time, the regime was really oppressive. So, even young people, and as soon as they, even just thought that they were involved in politics or so, they just picked them up for 180 days without detention, without trial. So by the 1970, you know, I just couldn't live there, so that's when I moved to Canada, you know.
So how did you get, so you only had 2 years university by that time. Mm-hmm. How old were you in 1970?
I was 24.
And what had you been doing at home?
So, what I did is I worked for a company in Johannesburg that was doing some computer stuff for the Johannesburg Stock Exchange, and I was doing accounting work for them, and that's when I got interested in computers, and so I picked up some stuff. But you know, for instance, you know, I was just so uncomfortable there, because if I wanted to use the washroom, I had to go outside somewhere at the back, you know, there would be a little washroom, you know, that we could use, you know, and stuff like that.
And could you use the same one as Africans?
Oh, yeah, we were using the same one, yes, yeah.
And so were you sort of overtly involved in any struggle, politics or activities then, or were you just trying to stay, sort of keep your head down until you could get out?
A bit of both. I was involved a little bit, but, you know, as the regime was so oppressive at that time, you know, that, you know, one had to be really very, very careful, you know, and stuff like that. And and that's the reason why my, you know, we just sort of, you know, did not bring to attention any of the activities, you know. And that's when I left to come to Canada in 1970.
How did you get to Canada? Did you come as a refugee or did you immigrate or...
So how I came to Canada was that I bought a return ticket, you know. I borrowed some money from somebody for the return part of my ticket. I came to the UK when I left. My passport had maybe about 3 months left on it, you know. And I knew that there was something going on, and some people even told me to, you know, leave, you know. So I came away, and when I got to, so I came to the UK, I said I was, when I was leaving, I said I'm going for a holiday, you know, going to the UK, Canada, the US. I went to the UK, I spent a week or two, and then I came to Canada. In Canada, I went up to, I did not have a visa or anything, so I went up. I came as a visitor, and then I went up to the immigration office in Hamilton, and I told them what is the situation. So they asked me, you know, what I was, you know, what was my profession and so on. And I said, look, accounting is what I've done and so on. And the guy said, listen, it's going to be very easy. Why don't you just apply, you know, as an account, you know, to get an accounting position here, you know, and so on. And don't bother with any other thing, you know. So that's the way I applied. Now, I was married at that time when I left South Africa, and my son was 1 month old. So I had to leave my son and my wife behind, and they joined me about 11 months later. And once I got to Canada, I had to find my way, and get myself established. So for the first couple of years, I just concentrated on finding decent jobs and, you know, getting myself established. And then after that, I got involved with, you know, different anti-apartheid coalitions and stuff like that. And then... in 1980 or so, or just after that, then I started raising funds for the ANC in Canada. And Canada, and this was from the grassroots, and Canada was the only second country in the world that was successful in raising funds from the grassroots. Of course, in the Scandinavian countries and so on, it's the governments that supported, you know, the movement in South Africa and so on. But so I had started that and very successfully did that, you know. In fact, the first campaign that I did, I managed to scrape up about $5,000 to have the first campaign. I was shocked. I almost fell off my chair when I saw a check of $5,000 from the Sisters of St. Joseph's in London. And so it was quite successful, you know.
And the money you were raising for the ANC in those very early days, was that going to Lusaka, or was there an ANC office in Toronto by then?
There was an ANC office in Toronto, so the money that I was raising supported the ANC office, but some of the money was going to Lusaka.
So who was the representative for the ANC to Canada?
Well, at that time it was Yusuf Saluji. Yeah, that was the representative, yeah. And I think he was the representative until 1989, I think. And then Peter Matlangu came along, yeah.
So how did you feel by that time that you considered yourself as a member of the ANC?
Okay, so, you know, I was told by London, from the ANC in London, don't join officially the ANC because we may need you to go back in to South Africa. And in fact, in that time, between 1970 and 1990, I did manage to go twice to South Africa.
To do work for the ANC, but sort of clandestinely.
Yeah, very quietly, yeah.
So at the time, the ANC office was getting established in Toronto and you were helping to do fundraising. What were the other solidarity organizations working on anti-apartheid movement work in Canada?
Well, there was Tickle Sack that was quite active. There was the Canadian, Concerned Canadians on South Africa, CC. Oh boy, I forget what it's called, but yeah, so they were this thing. And then, of course, the labor movement was quite active. And, of course, some of the churches also, you know, United Church and so on, yes.
And what was the relationship between those Canadian NGOs and the liberation movement and the ANC at that time?
So it was really not NGOs, but you know, different organizations, you know, like the churches, the labor movement, you know, Tickle Sack and so on, which had a very good relationship with the ANC office, their mission in Toronto, and as well as the ANC as a whole, you know.
So by doing this fundraising with the grassroots then, which was really, you were probably the first person who started doing that work in Canada. What was people's, why would they give you money? What was their perception of what they were donating money for? What did they know about apartheid, or what did they think about what was going on? Why did they care?
Oh, you know, it's amazing. People really cared. They, you know, really wanted, you know, South Africa to, you know, for the people in South Africa to get freedom, you know, and, you know, so they felt that the monies that they were giving, it was helping towards that struggle, you know, to reach, you know, someday freedom, you know, and stuff. So, you know, and also because this was monies raised for a political organization, there was no registration, no charitable status. So people did not even get tax receipts, you know, because of that. But still, we were able to raise funds, you know.
And was that fundraising then also a way of mobilizing grassroots support for what was the government doing at that time around, you know, do people know about Mandela? Were there discussions then about sanctions? Did people see their role as part of that sort of bigger political issue?
Yeah, and especially when you look at universities, students at universities and so on, really they were really the ones that really took the fight, you know, and, you know, got, you know, the government to do something. But the government, I would think, until probably close to mid-80s, really was not doing anything or even thought or had said anything about this the South African issue, you know. And it was only around the mid-80s that, you know, Mulroney, it was Brian Mulroney's time when, you know, the thought of the sanctions and so on. And then, of course, you know, his fight with Margaret Thatcher and so on. And, you know, sanctions were brought in, you know. And there were people like Archbishop Ted Scott, who was part of the Eminence Group of the Commonwealth, that did go visit Mandela, and that was the first group that met Mandela from the outside world. And, you know, when he came back, you know, I mean, I think he was quite instrumental in, you know, getting, you know, Brian Mulroney and so on, you know, on site, you know.
The church has played quite a strong role in Canada.
Yeah, very much so. Very much so. United Church, the Anglican Church, yes.
And a lot of connection to Desmond Tutu.
Yes. And, you know, Desmond Tutu's visit to Canada in 85 or 86 was, you know, really remarkable, you know. People, you know, there was just so many people that turned out for his events and stuff like that, yeah.
So when you were doing this, the fundraising work for the ANC, I mean, over that period of time, what prominent people from the ANC came to Canada? Like, how was there a public conversation now, aside from Tutu, who else came? And
there were many people that came. One I would think I remember very clearly is Thabo Mbeki that came down. And, you know, actually at that time I was not doing the or hadn't started the fundraising but for the ANC, but he managed to work with Oxfam, I think, and we were all donating to Oxfam for this particular stuff in South Africa, you know, and that went on for just maybe a couple of years or so. And by then I had started the fundraising, the unit. After the sanctions that were in place and so on, the fundraising for the ANC really, when I started, it was basically just around the Toronto area. And as we got along, you know, we got donors from across the country, you know.
And then you were quite involved in other solidarity organizations, which some of which I think you started yourself. Well, what were those?
Well, I would think, you know, in 89, in December, I got a call from the ANC in London telling me that they had set up the Mandela Reception Committee in London, which is getting ready because, you know, they think Nelson Mandela is going to be released from prison. So they asked, you know, can you do that in Canada as well? So, yeah, I got together with some of the supporters of the ANC and so on, and we set up the Nelson Mandela Reception Committee in Canada as well. And it was great to see the day he was released that evening. We had about 5,000 people on the Danforth, you know, celebrating the day, you know, his release. I wish we had social media or something like that, you know, at that time. And I'm sure we would have got many more people, you know.
Yeah. And I think there were, do you remember the event, 50,000 children in the stadium that Robert and Brenda Rooney organized?
So, I'll just go back to a little of this thing. So, shortly after the reception committee, Mandela came a few months later, Nelson Mandela came to Canada, and, we hosted him, of course, Brian Mulroney and the government had hosted him, but we also did some events, one at the high school I don't remember now. But then also we did an event at Queen's Park, and we had many, many people that turned out for that event in Queen's Park. So once, he went back, then the reception committee sort of folded up, but then another committee came out of it, and it was called EMSCO. It was called the ANC Mandela Support Coalition. And again, it was really set up to, support the ANC and, to move forward, right? So that went along for maybe a year or two. And then there was a conference that was in New York in 92, end of 92, that was held by the black trade unions in the U.S. And I went to that conference, and I met Billy Modise, who later on became the High Commissioner to Canada. But he was running an organization called Matla Trust, and he made a presentation. And he told, he said, they were doing the voter education and so on. So that got into my head. And then when I got back to Toronto after a meeting with a few people, then we set up a ad hoc committee called VSAC, Voter Education South Africa Canada. And then we also partnered with one of the organizations that I'm still with, IDRF. And so IDRF issued tax receipts for donations for that this thing. So we raised funds for voter education for women in rural areas. And IDRF also then applied to the government for funding. And we, within 6 months, we had about $768,000, which was fantastic, And Billy was very happy because that work, that was done in the rural area with women was really, really wonderful, And so after that, when ANC became the governing party, the government, and then I thought there has to be something else we need to do. So then I on one of the visits to South Africa at Matla Trust, I saw another organization there called the Nelson Mandela Children's Fund. So when I got back, I thought about it. And then we formed the Canadian Friends of the Nelson Mandela Children's Fund. So we started raising funds for that. And that was, we did early childhood development in rural areas in places like Kuruman, which was like on the border or right by the Kalahari Desert, and so on. So, and it went really well. We did that in eight communities and so on, and we did work with that with the Nelson Mandela Children's Fund for a while, for about 14 years or so. And then when Nelson Mandela Children's Fund changed their focus, then we just consolidated or merged with the Stephen Lewis Foundation because we were doing the same stuff. And then recently we formed the Mandela Legacy Canada, which is still in existence. It's not doing very much, but what we did is we managed, we celebrated the Mandela Day, you know, in Toronto with kids and so on. And also we then also managed to get University Avenue in Toronto, which runs right from Queen's Park to the lake dedicated to Nelson Mandela. So it's, you know, it says University Avenue, but on top it says Nelson Mandela Boulevard. What I forgot to bring up when with the Canadian Friends of the Nelson Mandela Children's Fund, in 98, we were just trying to launch it. I started in 97 to get it registered and so on. And then I was told that Madiba was coming on a state visit to Canada, and I found out that he was only coming to Ottawa. So then I got in touch with folks at the Nelson Mandela Children's Fund and said, look, can we not have him come to Toronto? You know, and so after some discussions, then they said, yes, you know, okay, we'll make it happen. So then, you know, we formed a group such as Robert Rooney, Brenda Rooney, John Piper, Gordon Bennett, Gordon Cressy, and so on. And then we had this event at Sky Dome with 45,000 children, which was called Mandela and the Children, you know, which was phenomenal, you know. Yeah.
So how would you describe the role of civil society in Canada throughout this period and their contribution to the anti-apartheid movement, especially sort of vis-a-vis the government? Because I think there was a lot of pushback and tension between those two during these years.
Right. So, you know, like I said, it was only around mid-1980s that the government turned around. But prior to that, I mean, there was a big struggle, even with the government, even with, you know, even Prime Minister Jean Chrétien and so on, and even before that, too. Where, you know, it was really the fight that the students at the universities, the labor movement took place, you know, the churches as well, with, you know, with the government to get them to come on site, you know, to, you know, support, you know, the sanctions and stuff like that. So, yeah, it was a big struggle, you know, for the civil society, really, to get the government on board, you know. But, you know, eventually, you know, around mid-80s, you know, that's the government did come, you know, on site.
Did you have much connection with the government in terms of your work, say, from the mid-80s? Or was you were really just focused on the grassroots fundraising?
I was really I concentrated on the grassroots fundraising. It was only around 2000 or so that I got involved with the government, you know, to get funding for the Nelson Mandela Children's Fund and stuff like that.
So I know you were just back in South Africa for your mother's 90th birthday.
Yeah.
So what is your mother's take on South Africa now?
Actually, I would say everybody or most people in South Africa right now are relieved and feel that maybe this is not the best, but it's much, much better than what they had with, you know, the Zuma government, you know, and are very hopeful, they, you know, that, you know, things will be a lot better, you know, especially for the person, you know, the working class and so on, you know. And, you know, the corruption, they really are very hopeful that, you know, corruption will be addressed. I think that's going to be a difficult thing to do. And also with the recent announcement of the new cabinet and so on, I was disappointed myself, and I think a lot of the South Africans are disappointed with some of the Zuma people, you know, still who were really a problem that are, you know, still in the cabinet and so on. On another part, I see that maybe doing this probably Cyril Ramaphosa is trying not to create animosity and so on between the large Zuma support, you know, and the rest, you know.
But if you go back to the 10-year-old boy growing up in a small town, and then, you know, from there to how did you feel when you were on the Danforth and saw Mandela walk from prison?
Well, just seeing Mandela walking from the prison, you know, I just, you know, it was just too much. It was overwhelming for me. You know, I never thought in my lifetime that, you know, that would happen. Honestly, although I always were, you know, I was fairly optimistic and all that kind of stuff, but, you know, I just didn't think it was going to happen. And then it happened so quickly, you know. And yes, I was, you know, just over the top, you know. But I was really overwhelmed and so on. And when
you met him for the first time?
Oh, it was just phenomenal, the aura around him. The first time I met him was in his visit here in 1990. But I had an opportunity when I went in September of 1990, which was, I think, about 2 or 3 months after he had been here. I actually was in his office with him, you know, and so on. And, you know, I'll tell you, he made you feel so at ease, you know. It was just amazing, you know, how, you know, and he was asking about my family and, you know, my kid, you know, and stuff like that, you know. And so it was really wonderful. This was at the Swiss Re building, you know, where the ANC had just moved in into South Africa. Wow.
The first time I met him was at Helen Joseph's 85th birthday party.
Right.
But I remember sitting with him in his bathrobe. Amina Frenzy and I had dropped by to see him when he was still living in the house in Soweto.
Right. Oh, wow.
In that little zozo.
Yes, yeah, yeah,
yeah.
Yeah.
So you've been through many ups and downs from the time you were a boy in Zierist.
Yes.
From Zierist to Toronto and everywhere in between.
Yeah.
Do you have any comment about, you know, maybe some lessons we could learn from how we did solidarity and our work with the liberation movement? Any lessons we can learn from maybe how we might have done things differently when we look back from today?
Yeah, the only, I think we did a pretty good job, you know, in Canada. But what I think, you know, that there should have been a much harder line with the government, you know, earlier on, you know, in getting them on site, you know. I think that just took a long, long time. And the Liberals were all saying all kinds of good things and stuff like that, but, you know, they didn't do a thing, you know, and stuff like that in, you know, prior to the mid-80s, you know, and stuff like that. So I think, you know, the anti-apartheid coalition and, you know, as a whole should have been really much more vocal and much more, you know, how should I say, more active in, you know, getting this thing by even having, demonstrations right, at Parliament and so on, this did take place, but not as many and not as vocal and strong, yeah.
Do you want to look at your notes and see if there's anything you missed that you want to add?
Yeah, I just wanted to say, my experience now, or our experience right now with the Mandela Legacy Canada, where what we really want to do is to make sure that Madiba's legacy remains alive in Canada, right, and so on. What we are finding is now there's very little interest in Canada, and we are finding it very, very difficult to raise some monies even to help us do some stuff where we were looking like, coming up with a curriculum, which we wanted to push in all provinces for it to be compulsory and so on. And and you need some money to do that. And unfortunately, we're not getting that kind of support anymore,
So I have one last question. What role do you think Canada played, both with the grassroots anti-apartheid movement and the strategic anti-apartheid movement, the steelworkers and Oxfam and Tiggelsac, mm-hmm. and the government? How significant do you think Canada was in helping to end apartheid?
I think Canada did a fairly good job, but again, as I said earlier on, I think, there should have been a lot more pressure, a lot more, from the different movement or the anti-apartheid coalition as a whole, to bring the government on board. The government came on board very late, really,
And why do you think the government was so reluctant? Was it their corporate interests in South Africa? They opposition to sanctions? They didn't want to offend the capitalists, or?
And that's definitely what it is. I mean, the only time the business community that came on board was, after the change in South Africa, when the first time that we saw this was when we did the event at the Sky Dome, with the 45,000 children, where it was the federations, it was the federations, it was even the private sector, that came along, and the government as well. So, prior to, 1990, or even a little, even after, I mean, sorry, prior to 94, the private sector really did not want to topple the cart or whatever it is, and that was the pressure for the government. That's the one of the main reasons why the government didn't do anything. Yeah.
This was an interview with Zeb Jiva, conducted by Susan Bazilli on February 28, 2018 at Carleton University, as part of the Canadian Anti-Apartheid Oral Histories Project.